From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with a difficult conversation in a school. One of the staff members, a man named Carl, had decided to resign. It wasn't an easy decision to make, but Carl realized that it was necessary for his mental health. He was struggling with depression, and he needed to go back home to Rochester. He approached his boss and explained how difficult things had been for him, and that he needed to give his 2 weeks' notice. His boss said he was disappointed since Carl was so good at his job, but he understood and he agreed it was the right decision. As the day went on, Carl said his depression seemed to get the best of him. He went back to his boss and explained that instead of 2 weeks, he needed to leave in one. Again, his boss said he understood. At the end of the workday, things had become even more difficult for Carl. He described that day in a book that he wrote about his mental health challenges, writing, quote, "I was standing outside with four of my male co-workers crying like it was nobody's business. I just didn't care anymore. I couldn't care less if these men thought I was weak or not man enough. I should have felt the Lord's compassion at this moment, but all I could feel was darkness. One of my co-workers spoke up and told me about how he once left his hometown to work someplace far and became really homesick at one point, too. My boss said to me, 'Carl, here is $100. Drive straight home and don't stop. Call me when you get home.'" End quote. Carl drove back to Rochester the next day. And after 2 years of struggling with depression, he found help in the form of medication. Since that time, he has made it his mission to help others who are struggling and to break the stigma associated with depression and other mental health challenges. Carl was fortunate to have a supervisor who understood his situation and was supportive of his needs. But not everyone has that experience, not at work. How should companies identify, understand, and respond to mental health concerns, both now and in a post-pandemic world? Our guests will share their expertise with us. And Carl Binger is one of them, a licensed mental health counselor and author of Progressive Darkness. Carl, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Hey, Evan, thank you so much. That was so well said. You're really great at your job.
Most of that is producer Megan Mack, let's be clear. But we're a team. Thank you, Carl. Michelle Pedzik, Chief Human Resources Officer at Canandaigua National Bank and Trust. Michelle, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Evan.
And Megan Clifford is a psychotherapist and a mental health first aid instructor. Megan, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me again, Evan. Glad to be here.
We talked recently, Megan, about mental health and some other challenges we're seeing. And this hour, we're focusing on the workplace. And I'm wondering, in this moment of transition, Megan, with people getting vaccinated, some people going back to work, some people going back to physical workspace, some companies demanding people come back to physical workspace. And there's a lot. There's just, we're in this strange space that I found myself reading Adam Grant in the New York Times last week, writing about languishing, where we don't necessarily feel like we're fully depressed, but we don't feel energy. We're sort of just going through the motions. There's a lot of that. It's hit me. What are you most concerned about right now, Megan Clifford?
Funny, I read that article as well. What I'm most concerned about is those kinds of folks who are languishing or kind of in that blah space, not having the support and resources, and those feelings turning into or manifesting themselves into a mental health condition or mental health concern. And for me, the reason why companies need to be mindful of this is because they have a huge role in supporting their workforce as they start to transition back. And that's a role that I don't think they have had before or have been so focused on. And it's going to be fundamental for companies to understand, again, how to identify and understand and respond, because it's going to be vital not only to the health and well-being of their employees, but to their bottom line.
Well, and you know, Michelle Pedzik, if you could just sort of give me a brief overview of what you're seeing at work when it comes to, you know, what the employees are telling you they want, what their needs are, and maybe if this is a period of adjustment for you, or are you finding that policies you've had in place have been able to handle this?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I do think it's a period of adjustment for so many employers. Our employees have so much on their plates, right? They're juggling home and work-life balance with trying to figure out what to do with small children and or school-age children that are on hybrid schedules or working, you know, during their schoolwork at home. So I think that a lot of employers, including CNB, are really trying to figure out how we navigate through this maze. And, you know, Megan teed it up so nicely. The mental health issues really impact employees in all kinds of ways and shapes and sizes, including us that are in leadership roles. So I think, you know, we use the term, you know, Megan talked about having a role for employers in reaching out and inquiring about mental health issues. I think we really have a responsibility to do so.
Well, and I want to ask both Megan and Carl about their own stories, because I think it's really instructive to hear the impact that can happen when either a supervisor, an employer is open to really working through this. And as we talk about this, it's sort of my sense, Megan Clifford, that this is kind of a generational issue. Let me explain what I mean by that. Similar to how we talk about working from home or working remotely, I see some parallels generationally with working with mental health needs, especially at work. When we talked to younger workers generally, not always, but generally, throughout this pandemic, there was this idea that, well, look, we're finally getting the evidence that we can be productive. Not everybody has a job where they can, but we can be productive at home or we can be productive remotely. And now you should give us this sense. And when I talked to older workers, generally, not always at all, but generally, there is some skepticism that, well, you know, younger workers just, you know, they don't want to work as hard, or they don't want to be in the office. They don't want to be held accountable. There are some stereotypes that happen that I have been hearing a lot, similar to mental health. There's this idea generationally that older workers might say, well, you know, we sucked it up. You know, we dealt with it. And younger workers might say, look, mental health is health. And you need to be able to work with me if I'm struggling. And older workers might say, well, you're trying to take advantage of that. I see some parallels. I wonder if you do too, Megan.
Yeah, I what I've talked about with some organizations, definitely with that generational thing, and I'm Gen X, right? You know, quickly, I'll tell my own story with that, right? I was in graduate school, and I think it was 95, you know, crying in my cubicle because I was experiencing a depressive episode. I had no idea what was going on, really. And I had a supervisor who was very caring, and he noticed. And he said, hey, you know, I noticed this. And he talked to me, and he encouraged me to go to my doctor. You know, long story short, I was diagnosed and treated, right? So bizarre back in that time that someone would come and acknowledge and support me in that. But what I what I hear from those millennials and the Gen Z is that's what they expect. So I look at folks in leadership positions who might be of those older generations that they're going to need to adapt and shift their mindset to understand that this is what their workforce is going to be demanding. So it is, the onus is on them to be able to adapt to the needs of their workforce. Or again, you know, 25 years ago, we got into a job and we stayed in a job. You know, people don't do that anymore. You know, they have something 7 to 9 jobs in their career, right? They'll go, you know, those employees will go to somebody else and work for somebody else who will support them.
How have you seen, Megan, in your own, from your own personal experience and now in your professional experience, how have you seen kind of the expectation? In other words, when you needed support, how likely were workers to get the kind of support you got versus now? How much has that swung?
I think it depends on the culture of the institution and who the leadership is of the institution, what their level of understanding in you know, education, mental health literacy. I think it you know, you can't judge each company individually, or you should judge each company individually based on what their leadership's understanding is. But, you know, I even had an experience later in my career where I had the opposite experience. Like, I had posted something on Facebook, a gratitude post to my boss who had given me a mental health day. And her boss brought me into his office and said, you know, why did you take a mental health day? Somebody else in the organization had brought that to him. And I was like, what? You know, it was a gratitude post. So, you know, those people, you know, that person was of a older generation or older style of thinking. I think, probably real late Gen X or early Gen X or baby boomer. And the fact that I would, first of all, take one and then, express gratitude for it. I actually, got talked to about it. Right. So it depends on what environment, generation, who's in leadership. Some of the smaller startup companies that have millennials and Gen Zs in leadership are going to be more open to that. I know my partner's company, Eagleview, is really open to folks taking the time when they need to take it. And as a result, their team is really productive. They don't take advantage of that. So I think it depends on who's in leadership roles and their understanding in mental health literacy.
Yeah, and when someone comes in to say to you, Megan, well, why did you take a mental health day? What is the implication of that question?
What's wrong with you that you had to take a mental health day? That is how that felt to me. Mm-hmm. And that goes to shaming, which is a whole other show. But what is wrong with you that you need to do this? And then you go to mental health in the bigger stigma in our culture of shaming people with mental illness. We don't do that with somebody with high blood pressure. We don't do that for somebody who has Crohn's disease. We do that with people who have mental health. What's wrong with you? Right. And that's how it feels when we're not supported, not only in the workplace, but in general.
Yeah, and I think some of that is probably just a trust issue, Megan. You have employers who say, well, a doctor can check your cholesterol, but if you tell me you can't be at work because you need a mental health day, I can't do anything but take your word for it. And I think it becomes about trust at that point. I don't know how you feel.
Yeah. 100%. That actually goes with a term I've been using for with workplaces is WPPE. So workplace personal protective equipment, right? And that role of your supervisor providing a safe and an opportunity to have safe and open communication so that, again, we recognize what's going on early and can have support and intervene and say, hey, let me connect you to EAP. Let me sit in your office with you and, while you make that call just to give you the support. Right. So when you're doing the workplace PPE, it's being open and safe. And I think when I think back to, and I'm going to name him, he's passed away, but John Seabach back at Child Protective Services in my internship, he made it safe for me to say, I don't know why I'm crying. I don't know. It just comes on every so often, and for him to create that safe environment for me made all the difference. And honestly, in my life, to be able to get treated for the anxiety disorder that I have.
Talking to Megan Clifford, who is a psychotherapist and mental health first aid instructor. Let me turn to Carl, who is a licensed mental health counselor and author of Progressive Darkness. First of all, generally, Carl, before we get into a little bit more about your story, generally speaking, what do you make of how employers respond to the term mental health day?
Well, I think generally it's not responded to very well. And I think just like in the story Megan just shared, it's typically not viewed well. I think it's getting better as time progresses and as people are made more aware and educated on this subject. But I think typically it's met with the level of skepticism. I've worked in multiple settings, I've worked in churches and local clinics and different places like that. And I think even in some church circles, it's met with some skepticism, and essentially people are encouraged to deal with it on a spiritual level. And it's almost like instead of a person saying, hey, how do I know, you're just kind of, selling me a line of bull, because we don't have evidence that you have mental health. I think sometimes with churches, they say, hey, we just want you to deal with it this way. If you have mental health issues, why don't you, read and pray, as opposed to, hey, let's get you some like medical help that you may actually need at this time,
Well, and for you, Carl, can you tell us a little bit more about your story that we mentioned in the intro, that, you know, you hit a point where, you know, you were moved very painfully to tears, and as you said, you didn't care if your male coworkers thought that you were, quote, not man enough. I mean, all those concerns about stereotypes, it seemed to wash away because it seemed that you were overwhelmed. Tell me what was going on with your life.
Absolutely. I got to just kind of start briefly with college, because that's right around the time it happened. It was my junior year at Brockport. And, you know, I think a couple of things contributed to that moment, before that moment. And I think with college students in general, there's so much pressure on them. There's the burden of finding a career. There's the financial burden of these crippling student loans. There's a diet, you know, within the student unions and these places where food is sold. They're usually not really great diets, and all those things played into my mental health at some point. But down in Delaware, where I was working, I had I was 1 month removed from graduating, so I had this burden of, where am I going to work, you know? And I'm in a brand new setting, you know, so there's a huge adjustment there. And I was already experiencing all the symptoms of depression. You know, I wasn't sleeping well. There were a lot of things in my life that I used to enjoy that I was no longer enjoying. And there was just this really dark curtain hanging over my life. And so by that time in the story where I'm, you know, talking to my boss, it had just gotten really bad. I was having heart issues. I was having sleep issues. And I was having very dark suicidal thoughts, where I could recall I had a vehicle that every time I stopped at a stoplight, the smoke would come from the hood of the car. And I wouldn't go to the mechanic to get it fixed, because I was just thinking to myself, if this car blows up with me in it, I just don't care. Like, I don't care about getting it fixed at this point. And so it was just this really progressive, dark, you know, just condition was just getting worse. And it just didn't seem to, for me, I really didn't have any education around what was going on. And a lot of people around me didn't either. And they were just really trying to find their own ways to fix the situation. And a lot of times it didn't help, some of the suggestions.
And when you eventually have a boss who says, okay, hey, you're doing great work, but I know you know, I understand why you're leaving work. Take the 2 weeks. Okay, take 1 week. Okay, look, here's $100. Just get home and call me when you get home. Can you contrast that with what could have happened and what the impact was?
Absolutely. So I've had other situations, real life situations, where, you know, people were telling me the exact opposite, and it was very hurtful. I remember all the moments, you know, painful and pleasant, you know, but I had people telling me, like, hey, you know, get over it, suck it up. You know, I recall dating this woman at Brockport, and her telling me, you know, hey, look, you know, you really got to suck it up, sort of thing. And, you know, I've had other friends around me just really, like, almost appalled, like, wow, you're still going through this, and kind of like, hey, man, you need to man up, sort of thing. So I was getting it from a lot of different directions, from religious circles, from, you know, secular circles, from men, women. It was just all everywhere. It was coming from every angle. And for my boss, who was a man, to say that to me, hey, here's $100, I just, even in that darkest moment, I felt like a tiny glimmer of hope, and I just it was just so impactful to me, and it still is to this day.
Where can people find your book, Carl?
Oh, Amazon, West Bow Press, which is who I had it published through, Barnes & Noble, so Amazon, West Bow, or Barnes & Noble.
The book is called The Progressive Darkness, and Carl is one of our guests talking about mental health, and specifically mental health in a work setting, and the response of an employer, a supervisor, colleagues that can help someone who's you know, having perhaps a rough time or working through something that is really structurally troubling, or maybe someone, an employer who is not handling it in a way that is productive and helpful. And we're talking to Megan Clifford, who's a psychotherapist and mental health first aid instructor, about this. Michelle Pedzik is with us from Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, trying to understand what, frankly, what people are going through. And I'm going to ask Megan to kind of describe, if you could, I know we kind of talked about this last time you were on, but I think it'll be helpful in this setting too. When people are dealing with this in a work setting, when people are working through what they may be emotionally struggling with when they go back to work, when their life situation changes, as a lot of people are right now, how do they work through, Megan, dealing with, is this right now? Am I actually depressed? Am I languishing? Am I struggling with change? Is this natural and expected? Is this something else? Is this, should I be concerned about chemical or clinical depression? Kind of like navigating all of those waters that can be hard questions to answer.
Absolutely, Evan. So when I look at the delineation between, you know, the word stress, the word pressure, the word depression, anxiety, sometimes we lump all those things in together. But when I'm looking at, you know, from a clinical perspective of a mental illness, so that is a cluster of symptoms that can be diagnosed by a professional, that would be the, you know, if I'm looking at a spectrum, that would be at the farthest end of the spectrum. And if I'm looking in, you know, at the very other end of the spectrum, we're looking at people who are adjusting to difficulties. So again, adjusting to COVID, adjusting and adapting to family changes or, you know, any kind of life change where they may have those symptoms. But once that stressor resolves itself, so do those symptoms. Okay, so that would be what I like to call a mental, emotional distress or mental health challenge. The other end would be a mental health disorder, right? So that's a medical, chemical, you know, condition we think of as a mental, it is a mental illness that can be diagnosed and treated. Those things on that first spectrum, you may do, you know, 3, 4, 5 sessions with a therapist and be fine. You may be on, you may decide to take a medication for a short period of time until those symptoms resolve themselves. You may do a combination. And then on that other spectrum, we know that when we have a mental illness, if it's not treated, it's going to get worse. You know, mental illnesses just don't get better with time, right? Treatment is necessary, whether that be psychotherapy alone, medication alone, or as I've mentioned before in the program, that gold standard of both of those interventions. So last point on that is, how do you know when you're in that one side of the spectrum or the more difficult? The way that we look at mental health diagnosis is if somebody is having the impact in 3 areas of their life. So if you're unable to go to work or school or be productive in work or school, that is one sign that we're moving into a mental illness. The other one would be, are you having difficulty in your personal interpersonal relationships? So are you being snippy at work? Are you not able to concentrate, not able to follow through on deadlines? Are you, you know, having difficulty with relationships at home or with your kids? And then the first thing I should have said is, are you able to complete what we call ADLs, activities of daily living, take a shower, you know, get up and eat, even if you have an appetite, you know, can you get your kids on the school bus? So if those things are being impacted by your symptoms, then we're looking at a mental health diagnosis and that treatment of psychotherapy, medication, or the combination.
And you mentioned an EAP earlier this hour, and I admit, Megan, it wasn't until recently that I was thinking about just, you know, EAP and access to mental health services through employers. Can you explain a little bit more about what that is and if that's becoming more common?
Right. So EAPs are employee assistance plans, and this is my understanding of it. I'm contracted with one of them, that somebody can go to their employer, and most large companies and employers have EAP, and it's on their websites, generally their HR websites for their workers. And what it does is the company pays for a number of sessions. So sometimes it's 3, sometimes it's 5. So somebody from the EAP company would call me and say, hey, can you take this, you know, 45-year-old woman who's going through a divorce and, you know, having anxiety? And I say yes or no. And, you know, so, you know, I would see that person for 3, 4, 5 sessions. Maybe it would resolve.
maybe they'd come to me and they, you know, and we'd say, oh, wow, I see, you know, you're experiencing depression. This has been going on before this life change, right? The trouble I have with EAPs right now, or the concern I have is if a company only allows for three sessions and that issue isn't resolved and it is a mental illness, then that person needs to agree or be able to compensate the therapist either through insurance or out of pocket, mm-hmm. right? So what happens when somebody can't afford to pay if they have a high deductible?
You stop going.
You stop going. If you can't afford to go to a psychiatrist, you know, you're kind of out of luck. So, you know, that's my concern with EAP, although I think it's a fabulous resource and I really encourage people to try, you know, to reach out to their EAP. Also being that that's not the be all and end all. And for, you know, an employer to be like, just go to EAP, right? Mm-hmm. And I think they do that sometimes because there's, you know, people are afraid of, you know, what if somebody does tell me they're struggling? I don't know what to do. I'm just going to put them, you know, put them to EAP. But that's just a doorway to walk through.
Yeah.
And there's barriers to continued support and treatment with that.
I mean, that is such an important point. I mean, I'm one of the most privileged human beings who has probably ever lived. And I have been both on a high deductible health plan where I thought about not going to the hospital when I had a medical emergency because I didn't want to pay a bill. I have paid for therapy happily. But I thought, if I start EAP, if I like somebody, then eventually I'm going to have to pay out of pocket. And then do I want to, you know, I mean, I am a super privileged person weighing this out.
Right.
Imagine someone who is maybe feeling like they're in crisis. And so, Michelle Pedzik, can you take me through how Canandaigua National Bank and Trust views the issues of making sure your employees are feeling confident that they can, number one, communicate any issues they have and also feel supported and have those resources that they might need?
Yeah, I'm happy to do so, and I would love to build on both what Carl and Megan have said. You know, at the end of the day, employees want to be, you know, they want to feel cared for, valued, safe at work. We all want a sense of belonging, and one of the ways that employers can help employees through crisis, either big problems or little problems, is to work with an employee assistance program. So we certainly do, along with many other employers. Megan is right. Most of those EAP programs, there's a limit to the number of visits. We at CMB, particularly our HR team, really pays attention and works really closely with employees to make sure they get what they need. For example, we'll pay for additional sessions should we need to. If we can't help somebody, make sure their insurance is covering it. There's also other resources depending on what the circumstance is, including calling 211, calling if it's related to COVID stress. New York State has a hotline, which does its trick in certain circumstances. But really, I think the key is having really great open communication with your employees. And, you know, we live, work, and, you know, used to play when we could actually get out and about together with our colleagues. So most of us have a sense of when something isn't going on or when someone is showing up but isn't really there. And we often ask the question, how are you doing? But really the question is, how are you really doing, is what we should be asking. So we try to treat everybody on an individual basis and try to figure out what the root cause is. Is it really a work situation where they just have too much on their plate and we can help them adjust? And balance that out with, we're not mental health professionals. We rely on the Megans and Carls of the world to really partner with us and help us make sure our employees have the support they need.
How are you really doing is going to be the question I ask my parents who have struggled with depression, health issues, especially in the last year. I asked my mom the other day, how are you doing? And she said, okay. And then I said, okay, anything going on? Well, she'd been hospitalized with double bilateral pneumonia. She's vaccinated for COVID. But she didn't want to tell me because I had a lot of things going on and I was in another state. So how are you really doing is a great question. I love that, Michelle. And I understand why people are hesitant. I mean, you can't make somebody open up, especially about maybe mental health, challenges. But if they feel supported at work, are you more confident that they will feel comfortable maybe verbalizing and asking for what they need?
100%, right? We don't hesitate if we know someone has a cast on their leg to ask them how they're doing and what do they need. So as employers, we need to move past that stigma and really, really coach and teach our supervisors and our colleagues on what signs do you really look for and how do you really figure out in a way where you're asking appropriate information and, you know, the good questions on what you can really do to help someone else. So I think that's one of the areas we all can, you know, really work harder on. I can't say enough about mental health first aid training. Many, many employers use, don't hesitate to train their employees on CPR or basic first aid for physical ailments. We need to put that mental health first aid training in the mix because it really could be a game changer if you can identify some issues early. Employees feel supported and valued, and then you're also making sure you have a place where someone can show up and be productive, whether they show up in person or virtually these days.
Well, and it seems to me, Michelle, that, you know, some companies don't want to offer, for example, paid time off related to COVID, paid time off related to mental health, those kinds of things, because there is a distrust that workers will be productive. Some companies don't want workers working remotely because there's, you know, maybe struggling with accountability mechanisms or productivity mechanisms. How do you balance all of that, particularly when this, for the employee side, they're struggling with increased togetherness, which can be great for families, but also stressful. Helping with kids' education could be great, but also stressful. And just sort of the rhythm of change. Some may have struggled with loss. Some might have a spouse or a loved one who lost an income. Some might have lost someone to COVID. I mean, there's so many things here that I think if there's trust with the employer, then maybe you say, okay, to pay time off's okay. But if you don't have that trust, I don't know how you work through that, you know?
Yeah, I think you're spot on. And I think that sometimes we worry as employers that our employees are going to take advantage of us. But really, at the end of the day, if you know your employees and you're supervising and you're checking in on them, you know that they're getting their work done. So adding these additional resources to them, and you hit upon so many of our major stressors with our own employees, right? So even if it's not to the extent that you have a mental health issue, we're all walking around carrying some baggage these days, mm-hmm. and we all need a mental health day on occasion. It doesn't matter what seat you're sitting in, we all need a mental health day. So I think that those really open conversations and that relationship building and that trust is really at the heart of the matter here and can get people through some of those rough spots.
Yeah, things have, you know, just the sort of snowball that can happen for me recently, and I found myself a little sharper with people or even sometimes with listeners who would email. So listeners, if you're someone who's emailed me and I was sharp with you, it's been tough, and it definitely makes me remind myself, we have no idea what people are going through personally. We just don't know. And there's so much.
Evan, could I just make one quick point that for folks who are concerned about employees not taking advantage of mental health days or things like that, I've done quite a bit of research on this, and I actually created a mock company for just this quick example. And there's a website that where it's called workplacementalhealth.org, where a company can put in their number of employees, and it spits out for them the financial consequences of them not intervening early. So I put this fake company in for 4,600 people, and it spit out to me that 376 of those employees will meet the criteria for a depressive disorder, and that causes, with that number of each person with 376 has 31 days of absenteeism each year and 28 days of presenteeism. Let me just put that in a number real quick. So when you do all of the crunching in this website, the cost on the low end for that company for not intervening with mental health early is over $4,900,000 on the low end. The high end would be $10.5 million. So that's astonishing. And when I do go into companies, part of my work as my Wellness Associates is my company, I give the folks those numbers and they're like, whoa. So if for nothing else, if your concern is your bottom line, then you need to put a mental health awareness program into your organization.
Well, after we take this only break of the hour, we're going to come back and talk to all three of our guests about whether you can expect and train companies to do things differently. And we'll talk about how to do that. And on the subject of PPE, you know, what does it look like for workplaces that want personal protective equipment in the way of mental health? You heard Megan Clifford mention that earlier this hour. We'll talk a little bit more about that. I want to read, as we go to break, a note from a listener who asked to leave their name out, but I will read this note now. They write, quote, "Listening to this conversation, last summer I realized I was struggling with pandemic-related mental health concerns and also past traumas creeping up. Recognizing I needed to see a therapist, I scheduled weekly appointments that continue to this day and sat down my boss, who is an executive at our organization, and said, I'm doing this weekly. It will take 1 hour out of my work time. I need to do this, and I need you to be okay with this. My boss was supportive, respects that time each week. I've told my peers that I've been going to therapy, and I know of at least two of my peers who then sought therapy for themselves. A combo of a safe, welcoming space and working to break down the stigma is absolutely key. Great conversation, and thank you." Powerful note. I'll ask our guests to weigh in on that when we come back, because this is somebody who not only said, I need this, but not only did they get what they needed when the boss, the supervisor said, okay, but they were able to then verbalize it to their colleagues who might have needed some space themselves. And now stigma's gone. Now it's something that you can talk about. Now it's something that you don't have to worry as much about. Important step there. Let's take that break and we'll come right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on the next Connections, the CDC, Dr. Fauci, the experts, they tell us get outside. The virus doesn't concentrate outside, it disperses. And if we're vaccinated, even better. We're much more protected outdoors as a whole during this pandemic. So why are festivals getting canceled? Park Ave Fest just got canceled. Others are on the fence. We take a look at the festival scene Wednesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So, Carl Binger, when you hear the note that we got from a listener who said, I sat my boss down and said, I'm going to need this, and I need you to be okay with this, and the boss said, yes, take what you need, and now there's a workplace culture where people are able to maybe not be fearful of stigma, what comes to mind for you, Carl?
I think that guy needs a raise. He needs a raise. No, but in all seriousness, you know, kudos to that man. I am very thankful for someone like him, and I really hope that many more bosses/executives will follow his lead. And I'm just very thankful for that listener who put that note there and for the encouragement that they received and were, you know, even able to have somewhat of a domino effect in a positive way for their coworkers. So I am thankful for that culture, and I really hope that that can be contagious and that could be the norm for other workplaces. So, you know, big shout outs to them for that.
Yeah, I agree. What do you think, Megan Clifford?
Thrilled. I don't think that's the norm, but I would love that to be the norm. Mm-hmm. And I think when you're looking at that workplace, you know, emotional PPE, you know, looking at how can we adjust, you know, staffing or schedules, you know, where possible, you know, how can we offer the, you know, what I call biopsychosocial support, the social work informed approach in the workplace. How do we, you know, provide that training in mental health literacy to our staff so that they know? Sometimes people don't know they're dealing with a mental health concern, right? When John did way back for me at CPS, I didn't know that's what it was. So how do we identify and then help that person adapt? And then again, we can't go over this, you know, more is the environment of open communication. And the last thing I'll mention, which I think we're not going to have a chance to talk to about in depth, but I think companies need to start understanding what it means to be a trauma-informed workplace. Trauma-informed is really understanding that everybody is coming in with something. there's not one of us who have not experienced individual trauma in the last year, whether it be individual from COVID or, you know, our Black and Brown brothers and sisters who have experienced individual trauma. And we've all experienced a collective trauma, right? So every single person is coming in with something. So it's vital that workplaces understand, how do we set the culture to be trauma-informed?
Well, and that's what, one of the things I wanted to talk about. I mean, this, in a sense, this is workplace PPE. This is personal protective equipment for mental mm-hmm. health and understanding what maybe trauma-informed means. So where do you start? How does that start, Megan, if a workplace is going to get serious about that?
Obviously, the open communication, the safety of being able to go to your work, go to the workplace and disclose and not feel like you're going to be shamed or stigmatized. We've talked about some of these. I'm looking kind of at the components, trustworthiness and transparency. So the fact that, you know, your workplace, the leadership is talking about this. They're saying, hey, come to us. They're posting things around the office. Are you struggling? Come to us. Peer support. Peer support's wonderful. I love the fact that I think it was the caller who said, I was open, I was vulnerable, and I told people I was doing this, and they got help. How awesome is that, right? Collaborating, being able to collaborate with other folks in your organization in a safe and confidential way. And then empowering people, right? Empowering them to have the agency to go and seek help. Here's how you do it. Here's some information. You know, if you need me to sit in the office with you, I'm perfectly willing to do that, because this is a scary thing to do, right? And then with a trauma-informed workplace, you really need to be mindful of, like, the demographic of your organization, including the cultural issues, historical or gender or racial issues in your workplace, whether you're dealing with essential or non-essential or a combination of those things. So, you know, this education, this mental health literacy that I talk about, I just feel so passionate about, as you know, Evan, I've talked about it before, that just that literacy can open up this larger conversation of what does it mean to meet people where they're at, knowing that all of us are experiencing some level of trauma right now.
Where would you send people? I mean, whether it's wellnessrochester.com or elsewhere, where do you want them?
Yeah. My website is wellnessrochester.com, and have the description of mental health first aid, where folks are welcome to contact me if they're interested in bringing that program to their organization. And I also offer some, 1 hour kind of lunch and learns or half day opportunities to increase workplace literacy, or even program you could bring to your staff, from an outside perspective as a clinician. So I've developed these things over the last 6 to 9 months, not the mental health first aid, but those other things, in a response to people like Michelle and other colleagues of mine that I've known. They're like, hey, we just don't know where to start. You know, we don't know what to do, or we don't know where to start. So again, it's kind of become a passion of mine to go into those places, especially after having the experience that was so positive when I was younger, and the one that was so discouraging, you know, a couple of years back. Please, I welcome anyone to contact me if they want more information. You know, I love to talk about this.
WellnessRochester.com. And I'm going to follow up on a point here with Carl and Michelle, and I think a phone call from Jane will help me get there. So I'll take Jane. Go ahead, Jane.
Evan, I've always observed in working myself that the boss is the boss. And if he wants to go play golf or go on a junket that probably shouldn't go on, he's gonna go. But he doesn't understand that the employees are watching this. And when he preaches to them about not missing any time or not wanting to give a mental health day, it seems really hypocritical that he can't understand that other people have the human needs that he has sometimes to get away from but I know that some bosses are really authoritarian and they're not going to bend, and that's not good in the long run. And sometimes it makes people come into work when everybody would be better off if that individual stayed at home.
Mm-hmm.
That's a scam call. That just came on my phone. But I've done that. I've said to them, when I took the job, I'm going to take a mental health day when I need it. But honestly, to one a year or something like that when I just knew I should not be here tomorrow because of tension building in the office. So I don't know. But could it be as bad, Evan, as PTSD? And I'm just wondering, once you've lived with stress for so long like we have, it just seems even more burdensome. And now some of the immediate danger has been tamped down with the election and so forth. Mm-hmm. But still, the tiredness, I feel it too. I feel very tired and being cooped up like we are, so we can't go out and see different places and do things. But anyway, I'm enjoying the program.
Well, thank you, Jane. And listen, I'm glad that you're onto it with scam callers. Scam callers, send your calls to me. Don't call Jane, okay? Leave Jane alone. We love Jane, and we appreciate that. And Carl, so here's what comes to mind for me, Carl. You know, Jane brings up the fact that employees are watching their supervisors and bosses lead by example. So so they could take off, and they can go play golf all afternoon and not expect employees to need sort of a break or an afternoon off here and there. And they can sort of, you know, set that example. And Jane's concern is that some supervisors are so generous with themselves, but not with their employees. But you experienced something different. The emailer who asked to remain nameless earlier this hour experienced something different. Is this something that is inherent in the person, Carl, or can you train people to handle mental health and with employees better?
That's a really good question. And I really do believe that you can train people and you can educate people around it. But I do think at the end of the day, it is within the individual to respond to that. And so I think, you know, like myself and the person who sent in a letter, we were fortunate enough to come across people who I think they have it in them to be that way. And maybe they receive some additional training as well. But I do think you do have to have the willingness to want to be that way too. You know, you can't just begrudgingly take a training and then just kind of throw it to the wayside. But you really have to reach inside of yourself and say, hey, do I really want to be this type of person? Do I really want to, you know, care for people in this way? And I think people can, but I think you can sense a lot of times when it's genuine or not, or when it's forced, you know. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that should discourage from trainings. But I do think there's just a giftedness to it. Like, you just know when people genuinely care for you, you know?
Yeah, I think that's really well said. I mean, it speaks to the importance of organizations choosing wisely. But also, as Carl said, you know, you can always make an effort to train and improve. And I wonder how Michelle Pedzik sees it. What do you think, Michelle?
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that Jane described the do as I say, not as I do box. So, companies can certainly do training. I think they have a responsibility, particularly to make sure their leaders and supervisors model good self-care, right, and share their own stories and really are open about what's happening with them. And when we do that as an organization, that does create that trust, and showing your vulnerability makes it okay to talk about mental health issues and reduces that stigma. It's one of the most powerful things we can do as employers. And training, we can coach and train our supervisors to, again, how are you really doing, right? We can train and teach that.
And Megan Clifford,
I want to give kudos to Michelle. Mm-hmm. I just want to speak to Michelle and kudos to her and CNB with the work that they've done over the past 5 years with opening up the conversation and normalizing and providing support to their employees. They're really a model. So if Michelle's okay with it, I do encourage folks to reach out to her to understand what they've been doing, because it's really a family at that company, and you can feel that when you walk in. So,
absolutely.
Sorry, I wanted to say that.
Thank you, Megan. She didn't even pay me. You know, I didn't pay her to say that, but thank you.
Well, we started this hour with Carl's story, and I'm going to wrap with just a question for Carl now. When it comes to stigma, what's the next step towards reducing stigma and kind of continuing on a better road here, Carl?
So, you know, I wrote that book because I just realized the liberating power of being vulnerable and letting people know that they're not alone. So I wrote the book, and I also started a Facebook group called Surviving Depression. And I've really just been trying to spread the word, the words of encouragement, to educate, you know, to bring hope and to break the stigma of depression and to essentially be a light to depression. So that's been my most recent mission. I started that group like last month, and it's about 400 people now, but I'm always reaching out. I'm always trying to grow the group. I'm always trying to do things in the community.
How do they find it, Carl? Real quick, how do people find the group?
Mm-hmm. Right on Facebook, Surviving Depression Facebook group, right on Facebook.
Right there. And Carl's book, by the way, is Progressive Darkness, telling this story, but also, frankly, it's a very hopeful story that includes some very real stuff, and it's important. And I'm really grateful for the time, Carl. Thank you for making the time for the program, and here's to continued success for you.
Thanks for having me.
Megan Clifford, psychotherapist, mental health first aid instructor. Let people know your website one more time, Megan.
WellnessRochester.com.
Thank you for being with us again, Megan. We'll talk soon.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Evan.
Michelle Pedzik, Chief Human Resources Officer at Canandaigua National Bank and Trust. Thanks for sharing your organization's perspective, Michelle.
Thanks for having me on, Evan.
Hope everyone listening is, feeling open and surrounded by people who care to hear it. And we'll talk to you tomorrow with Rob, Emma Ray, Megan Mack, and me right here on Connections.